I am very excited and thrilled to have this next guest on. She is a sensitivity strengthener, a high performance mental coach, and a mindful master of meditation, someone who I absolutely adored and I'm honored to host today. But I wanted to kick off this podcast by asking what I ask every guest. Hello, hi, who are you? How do we know each other? And where can people find you online?
Hi, Ella. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Jonna Genova. We met, I don't remember how many years ago, but years ago when I was teaching meditation at Equinox. And you were a very lovely regular who I was always excited to have in class. And people can find me on Instagram and also my website. Both are my names. So Jonna Genova, Jonna Genova.
Wonderful. And I will be sure to link that in the podcast notes as well. I loved taking your classes. I can't even begin to describe. I know I pulled you aside on more than one occasion because with your energy healing and your meditation practices, I had been practicing meditation arguably most of my life, if not all of it. And just your framework was bar none. I really, really enjoyed it. And I think what drew me most to you was when you would talk about your time in Tibet, and you would talk about working with monks. Is that the right terminology? I don't want to misspeak.
Oh, that's your terminology for like a role that exists. However, I don't know many monks. I know a couple, but most of my work has been with lamas, and lamas undergo a different training and a different set of like vows than monks do.
Oh, perfect.
There's some differences.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for correcting me. And just talking about this idea of there are people around the world right now meditating, sending you good energy, great vibes, praying for you. I mean, something about that still resonates with me to this day. And I was hoping you could share a little bit about how your spiritual journeys to Tibet and I believe Nepal have shaped your perspective on life and work.
I'm so happy that connected for you and still resonate. That could be like the essential aspect of the teachings, really, that whether we realize it or not, there are people near and far who are praying for our happiness and our well-being. And I was taught this and held in this through teachings for a long time before I actually saw it with my own eyes. And it was when I was traveling to Nepal. So I have not been to Tibet in this lifetime yet, but I've been to Nepal, and several Tibetans now live in Nepal. So there's an area, a neighborhood called Bodha, named Bodha because of a famous stupa, a religious site that is in the area, Bodhinath. And so it's this huge stupa, which looks like just a big white building. And people walk around the stupa as a form of prayer. Every day, people are walking around the stupa saying prayers, offering prayers to other people. And I brought that home with me and to hopefully all of you as not just a concept, but an actual thing that is happening.
Oh gosh. I mean, I loved it. It's so resounding. And even hearing you say it again, echo that there are people praying for your happiness. It just gave me goosebumps hearing you say that, because gosh, what a sense of peace if we could try to remember that. I think it's easy sometimes for on a macro level say, oh, the universe has our back, or God, whatever spiritual realm we might speak of. But when you say yes, that as well, but actively, there are individuals who are thinking of you, even if you don't know they exist, they know you exist. It's so beautiful. And I really appreciate that. And I do apologize and feel like such a silly, ignorant American that I don't know why in my head I conflated Tibet and Nepal. And so I do apologize for that, because I'm sure that is such a misnomer. And I put my foot in my mouth, so I do apologize there. What is Nepal like? Is it beautiful? Is it deserty? I don't have an exact visualization of it, but what is that world, that side of the world, like?
Well, first of all, I can understand why you just switched Nepal for Tibet, because my teachers are Tibetan. The lineage of practice that I study is originally from Tibet. So, and then, like I said, there's this whole area of a neighborhood in Kathmandu, the capital of Nepal, that is predominantly Tibetans. So I imagine it looks like a lot like Tibet, right? So both Tibet and Nepal have areas that are at very high elevation. So Mount Everest is there. And so with this comes a pretty harsh climate. It can be cold, mountainous, snow. And then there are also areas at high elevation that have beautiful green plateaus. So the landscape of Tibet shapes and influences the practices in some ways. Let me feel into this as I describe it. So the people of Tibet are nomadic. So as they would travel with their family and animals, imagine traveling at crazy high elevation, cold temperatures, winds that can be 40 miles an hour, and essentially like camping as they move along, right? So these are not easy conditions. But they were meditating. So as they're just living their lives in what we would consider pretty harsh conditions, they're engaging in prayer and meditation. So if we contrast this to how people expect to meditate in the U.S., and like a pristine, I don't know, white meditation studio with soft music in the background, it just doesn't like connect. I suppose that is like one way of meditating, but the practices are supposed to help us with our daily life and just be a part of our daily life. So kind of going off on a tangent there, but the prayer and meditation is woven into the lifestyle of people in Tibet and Nepal, at least those who are Buddhist. It's seamlessly woven.
You just unlocked a memory that I completely forgot about until right now, which was, and again, this is something that where you stood out for me as a meditation instructor in my life, was that you said, don't leave yourself at the door. Bring all of yourself here. And I unknowingly, subconsciously would do that. And I think it's because of some of the practices I had as a child in martial arts, where you are told to leave yourself before you enter the mat. And I think that was probably reinforced. And so this idea of, okay, I'm going into a yoga studio, meditation studio, to your point, a white pristine room. I need to leave my mess at the door, at the threshold. And I would have that mindset every time walking in. Okay, Ella, we are going to strip away that and sit here. And when you said that, I had this visualization of, wait, no, the body bags of Ella's issues, they got left at the door. They don't want to come here. And converging the two was a really beautiful new way of looking at it. And so now when you add this context, Mount Everest, the harsh elements, the cold conditions, this idea of you don't step away into a quiet, peaceful, meditative area. You take it with you everywhere you go as you're walking through, as you're moving along and being mobile, as we are in the real world. It makes so much sense. And wow, I can't believe you just unlocked that. And like, to your point, I don't know how many years ago this was. It's been wonderful following you ever since. When we look at nature, which I mean, it's hard to talk about meditation and not nature and weather and seasons and landscapes. Did you grow up close to nature? Did you grow up in Southern California where we met?
I grew up in a rural community in upstate New York and experienced all of the natural elements. Lived on a Great Lake, and there was a lot of snow in the wintertime, a lot of wind just ripping off of that lake, beautiful summers. My family had a farm and garden, so I was deeply connected to the earth without even trying to be. In addition to that, being in a small town and it being the 80s, I spent a lot of time just wandering around by myself. We had these, I lived on a dead end street, and at the end of the dead end was kind of a small forest, I guess. And I would just go and explore in that forest and let my intuition guide me wherever I wanted to go. And I would use my imagination a lot and talk to the trees and just commune with nature.
I really, really, really love that because, one, this is the first year of my life where I started growing my own food. And I choked up a little bit. It sounded probably like a laugh, but I was actually holding back cheers because I started growing food this year. And what was so unexpected to me about growing my own food, and I'm only growing, I say growing my own food as if I have this huge garden like your grandfather's that you mentioned. I'm just growing basil and jalapenos right now. That's it. But so it's not necessarily sustenance. However, what I didn't anticipate was the empowerment of feeling like I made this and it's mine and I didn't have to get it from anybody else. I can just go out to my city apartment patio and pick jalapenos, which I did yesterday. It just feels so really confidence building, like, yeah, I can make life. And I didn't realize how good it would feel beyond, yes, it tastes fresh. And it's an accomplishment, sure. But the confidence of going, huh, I can do this. And now I want to expand. I want to go into fruits and vegetables beyond the spices. And you also, when you said strawberry and then corn, that's exactly when I got caught up because where I grew up in Southern City, California, what a lot of people don't know about Orange County, where you and I met, is there's a reason why it's called Orange County. We were known for our own orange groves and specifically the neighborhood where I grew up. I grew up passing through strawberry fields and corn fields. And so we would pull over on the side of the road on like Thursday and Friday nights. And my dad would say, okay, we're going to get some bushels of strawberries. And if you were a local who they recognized, they would let you go pick some of the strawberries. Like the kids, we were allowed to go pick a few. And this is off the side of a road. It's off the side of a main road. Doesn't sound quite as majestic and perhaps a little remote as where you grew up. But the corn, when it was corn season, oh my gosh, I'm getting excited again. I started recognizing the corn by the color and going, oh, I don't want that corn. I want the white corn. It's sweeter. And just feeling excitement about which corn I wanted to pick. And fast forward to today, that exact field is now a literal strip mall and a gated community. They completely got rid of that patch. And it makes me, of course, sad seeing evolution and change in that direction is sad. But for me, when I hear you talk about putting your feet in the ground and talking to the trees, and I think about even where I grew up in quote city type California, I still had a piece of that experience. And now that has been stripped away through a strip mall that has a Target and a Barnes and Noble now. It is, you make it sound so magical, like the secret garden. You talked about your grandpa's, I'm trying to visualize your grandpa's garden. Again, looking at my tiny patio garden, that's like four pots. Is there a particular way that you grew up, bearing all of this in mind, that made you proud?
I didn't realize it at the time because it was just normal. But my grandfather was really proud of that garden. And thinking back, when we would go out to the garden together, there was always work to do in this garden because it was so big, you know, weeding the garden. So when I was over at their house, often we'd go out in the garden and work in the garden. And although it was work, there was a really, it didn't feel like work because he was proud of exactly what you were describing. Like, I did this. I tended to this. I remember planting seeds with him and the sense of connection. You know, there's something like, I did this, but also it wasn't alone. It was with the earth, with water, with those seeds, right? Kind of cooperation that's expressed through a garden that I'm just kind of noticing now through your sharing and thinking back to hanging out in the garden with him. And he was so loving. I'm sure that's why his garden was as incredible as it was. The loving attention that he gave to it, the way that he did things and taught me to, for example, plant the seeds and have respect for even the seed, was very loving. And this is really, I mean, wow, your questions are really opening up a lot for me right now. So I often think about him and wonder how he became so loving, knowing how he grew up. So he was orphaned before he was in the seventh grade, and all he had brothers and sisters, and they were all put into separate foster homes. And this really worried him. You know, he was worried for their safety. There was something inside of him that didn't want the kids to be separated. So he quit school in the eighth grade and got a job so that he could get them an apartment. And the stories I've been told were that, you know, it was a really basic apartment with, I think, one mattress, but at least they were together and they were under one roof. And that was something that was shared with me because I would ask Grandpa what he wanted for Christmas or his birthday, and he would say, I just want us to all be together. So this has been a family value for everyone, just to be together as the most important thing. But I wonder about him. He said to me once that he knew it was time to come home when other kids' parents were calling them inside. He didn't have anyone to call him inside. And when I think about, like, what I know about the development of humans, when we don't have a lot of love, and they say when we don't have secure attachment, we don't really learn how to love others. I don't know where he learned to be so loving, but he definitely embodied unconditional love. And it wasn't something he turned on and off. It was all the time.
Last season, I would often say, don't make me cry. I won't let you make me cry. And I have tears welling in my eyes. I'm glad you can't see me. I'm glad our videos are off. He sounds like such a beautiful man. And I think for me, when we talk about losing our parents at a young age, when we talk about children losing their parents, I'm still very blessed to have both of mine. And then we talk about this child getting a job to make sure his brothers and sisters are all under the same roof, and relying on witnessing the love and security of other families to kind of emulate what to do. And then thinking today about some of the work that I'm able to do in the foster care system, it's very, very awe-inspiring. He sounds like such an incredible man. And I was envious, as you were talking about the garden, I'm always envious of individuals who have close relationships with their grandparents. I love my grandparents, the ones who are still here, but I didn't grow up close to them, neither geographically or emotionally. So I didn't always have that kindredship. And so I'm hearing you with your grandpa and just having these beautiful, sweet visions. And then every time I hear the story of a loving person who came from brokenness, I am reminded that I myself am not my past, and my past is nowhere near as arduous as that is. And it is incumbent upon all of us to take the pain, the loss, the suffering, and turn that into a compassion, an empathy, a sensitivity that we can create a legacy of love. And I can only imagine what a thankless job it would be to become a parent at 12, 13 years old, as he did, and corralling these children who are not your children, but they are now a responsibility that you willingly are taking on. I mean, wow. I so thank you for teaching us about your grandpa. What was his name?
His name was John, and I'm named after him.
Oh, Grandpa John. Oh, Grandpa John, I love that. And you were named after him, so you are certainly carrying on the legacy. Gosh, what a torch to be passed on. Would you say that your upbringing was different?
Again, in a small town, I didn't know any different. What it felt like when I was growing up was that everyone was kind of the same, at least like economically, and also in terms of how people think. And I would say that my family stood out because the town I grew up in was mostly white, like Irish or Polish. And so my skin was darker, my hair was different, but not different enough to like really understand what was going on. The food I brought to school was different than other kids. They were having ham and cheese on white bread. We never had white bread in my house. We never had canned jarred tomato sauce in my house or powdered garlic or something. So, or cereal, like sugared cereals. And what I've heard now as an adult from people who I grew up with is that my family seemed more sophisticated. I felt different. I felt like I wanted to, bring a lunch into school like everybody else had. But what made us different was that my mom and dad are second generation.
Mm-hmm. May I ask what their background is? What your background is? Because you said the food. Now yeah. I'm like making idea. I'm like, what food was she eating?
So my mom is Polish and Lebanese, and my father is Sicilian and Hungarian. And I would say that we grew up with like all of those cultures, probably least of which was Hungarian.
I will say, since the listeners can't, the eavesdroppers can't see you right now, you certainly fit the prototype of wow, 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 wow. You are absolutely stunning. And anyone who wants to see what Jonna looks like, again, we're going to link all of her information into the notes, but you are absolutely beautiful. I don't wonder people's ethnic background very, very, very rarely. And to be frank, you are not someone who I would have asked that except within the context of the food. I have found it a little off-putting how often my entire life I have been asked what my background is. And I've never understood that need to know. It is not lost upon me that you are absolutely stunning. And I can't wait to post a photo of you for the podcast. Bringing it back to conformity and really thinking about being different than other people, which, I mean, look, we're all different, right? Even in our families who are arguably the same people as us, if we take it on a macro level, we're just about the same people coming from the same areas and so forth from our families, but we're still so different. But from a standpoint of conformity, because I can relate to having different lunches, there was no white bread in my house either. I grew up in a, we'll say, granola type home. We were organic before organic was cool or trendy. And let me tell you, that was not an easy childhood. When everyone else has the Gushers and the Fruit Loop and red dye, red food coloring dye number 42, and I'm showing up with my nutty bread and my big whole grain thick, nutty bread with the chunky organic oil dripping out of it, peanut butter and the fresh jam preserves. It's like, it's not a peanut butter sandwich. It doesn't look like one. It doesn't fit in Ziploc bags because the bread was too thick. I so desperately just wanted to be normal and fit in, but Lord, if I tried, I couldn't. It doesn't work. No matter what I do, I would die. I would die to ever step into a room full of Ellas, because I don't think I could handle it, because I'm just so used to being the only of myself, whatever that might be, the only person who eats a certain way, the only person who speaks a certain way or whatever. I'm just so used to being so not normal, if that's fair to say. And I've really embraced it. I think I've gotten used to it at this point. But from your perspective of having that background, and again, I think a lot of people can relate, have you seen that as a challenge, a strength, a mixture of both? And then where does that show up in your professional field, which I haven't even been able to talk to you about quite yet? But how do you feel about nonconformity or being unconventional in today's world as an adult?
Yeah, like you, Ella, like I can't be quote normal even if I try. Like the same with the bread, and I'm laughing about the peanut butter. Yes. We would even sometimes for fun make our own peanut butter, like smash peanuts with, you know, oil dripping, homemade preserves. Yes, and I knew about red dye. My mom told me that, or I don't know, trained me to look at the ingredients list. So all of that is just making me laugh so hard. It wasn't my choice. I've just come to accept that, like you, I'm used to being the one who's different. And at the same time, there's a tension there that as I get older and better understand it, I become more comfortable and empowered asserting myself when I am different. And so, for example, not just like we've talked about maybe what we look like or what we eat, when it comes to my thoughts or my perspective, which is influenced by how I look and what I eat, I now am attuned. I think this comes from not quite fitting in anywhere exactly. I'm attuned to the inherent biases that people have. This actually connects to my study of Tibetan Buddhism, so I can use that as an example. When I first introduced to the culture of Tibet, it was 1996. And at that time, geographically, the country is isolated. By language, it's isolated. We're also brown people, and China doesn't recognize Tibet as its own country. So for a lot of reasons, the larger world, the Western world, we're not paying much attention to what goes on in Tibet. And I was studying and learning about the culture of Tibet and how people think and how they view wellness and happiness. Simultaneously, I was pre-med in college and studying psychology and recognizing that, gosh, what I was being taught in those science classes about what wellness is contradicted how people define wellness in Tibetan culture. And so I was pretty assertive. Like, I really wanted to point that out, whereas other people didn't think it mattered. Meaning the people who didn't think it mattered were those holding dominant culture. They didn't seem to think it was important that someone else had another view, and they didn't seem to appreciate that that view could be equally valid or should be investigated or considered. And so I find myself like I've got this like little, like, I don't know, internal beeper that goes off when there's an inherent bias functioning for someone, and or an unconscious bias functioning for someone. And I'm kind of embracing, as I look back on my life and look back on being the one who's often different, I'm embracing the possibility that this is part of my purpose in life, is to raise my hand and speak up when I notice this unconscious bias functioning. And part of what permits me to do that is because I don't quite fit into anything. So I'm maybe less, I could say things that someone who looks more different than dominant culture could say. Like I could get away with a little bit more. It's still really uncomfortable. I'm still, when we look at power dynamics, I'm still having to work against the power dynamic and to be brave in those moments. And I see that I'm, it might be easier for me to do that than for someone else. So I step into that. I make myself have the courage.
When you say power dynamic, are you referring to you're out at a grocery store in your everyday life, or are you referring to your professional career life? Like, can you elaborate, expand on that a little bit?
It's everywhere. It's everywhere. So I noticed that, so I had been living in Orange County for a while, where you're from. So you know what it's like there. It's mostly white and people who have lived there for generations. And I would find that my presence made people uncomfortable. And so there's a power dynamic there, multiple power dynamics functioning. So that would be an out in a grocery store, just like choosing to live there and take up space is one way that I would work against a power dynamic. I mean, I also did things like I would put books out in my front yard for free for people to read. And many times the books were just like, no one would pick them up because they were books that would provoke thought about power. And so that's one side. Another side professionally is interesting. I mean, and then as we all know, like showing up as a woman in this world, we can't help but experience the power dynamic that exists. Gosh, they're so, I think it's all, the power dynamics are happening in every moment. And I am thinking now of the work of Leticia Iñeco, and she describes these dynamics with a few really helpful, her framework is really helpful, a few helpful phrases. And one is, we, in any moment, we are part of either the target group or the agent group. And so my gender, my skin color, my economic status, my physical abilities, my age, my religion, place me in either as either the target or the agent in any moment. And we just, as humans, even if we don't have this framework that she outlined, even if we haven't been taught about power dynamics, we feel them. And she describes that as rank. Like, it's almost like a smell, like a palpable thing in any given moment. And I don't want this to be mistaken as a victim mentality, because that's not what not the stance I'm taking. I'm actually taking the stance of seeing what's happening here. My gender, my skin color, my religion, although I was raised Christian, I've now been studying Buddhism for longer than I was a practicing Catholic. I would say also being neurodivergent is a factor in how I experience the world and how people experience me. There are several times when I am in the target group, when, just because I'm embodying who I am. So, and then professionally too. So in some worlds, I'm seen as highly educated, but in some professional circles, I'm around people who are researchers and academics and have PhDs. And so there, I do not have power. This is kind of going in circles. I guess it's just like all power dynamics. It's a little tough to untangle because it's really like interconnected in a way, interdependent. And a part of maturing for me has been being taught and shown what these power dynamics are and saying, oh, that's what was going on in that moment. It wasn't really that my idea wasn't as good as someone else's. It was that they were resistant because of another factor, another feeling in the room, which might have been my age or my gender.
Or maybe in a particular moment, there was a voice I didn't hear in the room because I was a part of the agent group and I wasn't open and holding space for someone in the target group or creating space, a safe space for someone in the target group to share their voice. So I also seek to share this, help people understand the complexities of any interaction as a way of bringing healing.
Absolutely. Well, I do, and I don't want to undermine anything you just said, but again, I have to stress that you are stunning. You are, and when I say stunning, I'm talking about the kind of beauty where I would imagine if I were to put a little camera on your shoulder, that you're the kind of person that people take a double take at, they're staring at, because you are just exquisitely beautiful, and it can be overwhelming for people. And I'm only recognizing that in this season of my life. I had someone pull me aside and ultimately say, you don't have the opportunity to be mean, disparaging, difficult, lazy, blah, 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 because your beauty is a gift and a burden. You are put here to spread a better message, right? You were given this gift, beauty, and it was so interesting. And it was, again, another stunningly beautiful woman like you. She was 6 foot and towered over me. And I just thought, wow, you're gorgeous. And she's like, it is our duty as beautiful women to instigate change because people listen to us more. And there is something so, so special about you. And the perspective that you bring, I'm so, so, so grateful that we met. And I'm really grateful that you joined today. I feel like I went on a really weird tangent there, Jonna. How, if I may end before we close it out, if someone is on an unconventional path or they find themselves different, do you have a word of advice on how to find a sense of belonging and how more of us can create a sense of a belonging?
First of all, if you are feeling like you are in the margins or different, I would say something encouraging to you. Like, thank goodness we have you. We need people who, so I often think of this world, I'm beginning to see it as a lot of bell curves existing. And if you feel like you're on the tail end of this bell curve, so there aren't a lot of people like you, as you were describing, Ella, when it comes to your beauty, and in the season, embracing it and seeing that it must be there for a reason. I think that's true of anybody who is on the tails of any bell curve. We need you. The world needs diversity. The natural world does. As humans, we do. In terms of ideas, we need you. So please don't dim your light or lose that. And the way that I have seen to embrace and harness the differences is to find other people who also feel different. They may not feel different in the same way, but for example, our conversation about being different here today, hearing your experience makes me feel more comfortable in my differentness, right? Like this shared experience of being different is a way to find greater comfort in that difference. And then my professional work is helping people who are on these tail ends of the bell curve to keep pushing, push out as far as you can. Let's see what else is out there. What else can you show the rest of us and embody, embrace, do, see?
Yes, I mean, we didn't get to talk about that too much, but as far as your work and your purpose and everything that you're doing in the world today to help people in the professional world, are you taking on, I know you work with high performers, is it fair to say, is it only in the NFL space somewhat and all sports, or I know you work with high performers and high achievers, but Is it to a specific space or is it a little bit more broad?
It just so happens that 99% of my clients right now are NFL players and coaches, but I'm open to working with anyone who's different, who would like support in allowing their brilliance to be here. And it's challenging for a lot of reasons to do that. Like, we may not have a model of how to do it. You know, we're pushing the edges. And with that comes insecurity, feeling of loneliness. Also, who do we have to share our ideas with or to share our difficulties with? I think it's really valuable for people who are pushing boundaries to have support. I don't really see my role as, for example, if you're a wide receiver, I'm not going to tell you how to do your job better, right? Like, I've never done that in my life. But I can encourage you to lean into who you are. I can support you in healing the limiting beliefs that you have about yourself and others so that your limitless nature can shine through. So when we are looking for help, I find that people who are pushing the edges, a reason why we might resist reaching out or getting support is because no one understands us. But that's not really what can be happening in a relationship where the person pushing the edge is getting support. What can be happening is that someone understands at least a part of you or understands that you're doing something no one else has ever done before. It's not about me telling you how to do it because I haven't done it before. That's the nature of being unique. But it's holding a space, helping you to claim a space in the world. And going back to the feeling different, I want to get the quote exactly right. One of my favorite quotes, most empowering things I've ever heard is from Toni Morrison. I stood at the border, stood at the edge, and claimed it as center. Reorienting ourselves can be deliberating.
Oh, I love that. Can you say it again for me? I really want to soak it in.
Yeah. I stood at the border, stood at the edge, and claimed it as central. I claimed it as central and let the rest of the world move over to where I was.
I love that. That is a way more poetic way of the one that I've been saying since MySpace day. If you're not living on the edge, if you're not living on the edge, you're taking too much space. This Toni Morrison quote is way nicer. And again, I'll link that in the podcast as well. Well, Jonna, I really think that I could talk to you not only for hours on end, but I really, really enjoy speaking with you. And as we close out in season two of this podcast, I came up with a philosophy last year that, and Seth is just a term I made up. It just means spiritual, emotional, financial, physical. Is there an area where you feel particularly strong, a vertical and dimension where you feel particularly strong? And in that same vein, is there one that you're just hoping to develop a little bit more today?
This is a beautiful framework. Yes, emotionally, I feel stronger than ever. And it is an area where I also feel like I have the most work to do and have maybe some insecurity there around a sense that there's more development there for me. And then, so I guess that fits into both in some ways. But then I would also say financially has been really interesting. I've always been able to manifest things. Like, I've had so many jobs where no one ever had that type of job before. I just started doing something and just believe, do what you love and the money will come, and do something in alignment with my purpose and somehow I will be taken care of by the universe. But one area that is like a point of tension is, in fact, one of my clients, a former client, sent me a text the other day saying, you know, you would do what you do for free. And I said, is it that obvious? And he wrote back in all caps, yes. So I think I'm wanting to explore and define for myself the value of money in this lifetime. Because for the most part, I really don't think it's that big of a deal. But I know that we need it, right? Like, I know that there's a lot of suffering that happens when we don't have basic needs met. So just that like sort of like spiritual meets material world tension, and just making a human decision about that for myself.
I will tell you on this podcast, this season, money is going to come up a lot. I think we as women do not talk about it enough. It is something that we will have some episodes on the podcast to help just get some juices flowing. Because to your point, like, there's so much abundance to be had, but there's a little bit of strategy that we sometimes also need to have when converging that side. So kudos to you. And thank you so, so much for sharing your time today, your background, your energy. I am in no way surprised that I don't know about you eavesdroppers, but I feel ooey gooey warm after talking to Jonna. I have a feeling I'll be listening to this episode several times over just for when I want to feel good, because you have such a beautiful gift with your brilliant mind and the way that you look at the world. And I know it was really just the tip of the iceberg here, but I just so appreciate that you've been able to share. And I do hope that you will be willing to come back sometime.
Anytime, Ella. Thank you for creating this space. And also, thank you for what you're doing in your life right now. The book that you've written, stepping into your power as a coach, is inspiring and paves the way for more people to live their lives fully. So thank you for being you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Eavesdrop with Ella. If today's episode inspired you to pursue personal or professional growth, visit my website, ellayourbella.com, where you can find more empowering content and resources. You can also contact me directly for a consultation so we can transform your challenges into triumphs together. Until next time, this is Ella Parler reminding you to stay resilient, stay abundant, and above all, stay balanced. Subscribe, share, rate, and review this podcast to help us connect with more eavesdroppers just like you. Thank you for eavesdropping, and we'll catch you on the next episode.
You've been listening to Eavesdrop with Ella, a production of EP Consulting. Some of the products and services mentioned are paid promotions, and any advice should be confirmed with a qualified professional. Opinions and ideas are for entertainment purposes only and belong to EP Consulting. All rights reserved.
Boom!